I'm Marco Werman. We've reached our goal for the spring fundraiser. The world raised $134,000. That's $134,000 to help pay for the reporting that you depend on each day. It helps us meet the cost of bringing you the news, and it's proof that you value the world's journalism. Thank you for helping us make the world available for free to everyone. If you meant to contribute, there's still time. Go to theworld.org/give. And thank you for supporting the world. Did you feel it? The touch of another human? Its absence has been one of the hardest parts of life under lockdown.
It would be nice to be able to go out and hang out with someone and hold their hand. You know, something as simple as that.
We've also missed going to the movies. In South Korea, they've come up with a few workarounds.
At this no-contact theater, the ticket takers are two roving robots. The snack bar is automated, too.
And Richard Branson and his Virgin Empire, a business that grew in tandem with a high-flying, charismatic risk-taker.
The problem is, he's 69 now. He's not going to start jumping up into balloons and going around the world.
And for a business built around tourism, Branson's empire is now in trouble. I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today on The World. Depending where you are, it was another weekend of no restaurants, no shops, social distancing in the park, maybe. If it felt kind of normal, it means we're getting used to this. It's hard to believe, but it's been nearly 2 months since the World Health Organization officially declared that we are living in a pandemic. Looking at a world map, it seems like no part of the globe has been spared. We're up to 3.5 million cases worldwide. The World's Ilana Gordon covers global health for the show. So just what is the state today of COVID-19 and its reach across the globe, Ilana?
Well, Marco, as you said, this virus seems to have really made its mark across the globe. The U.S. is at the top of the list in terms of cases and reported deaths. And then there's also places like Spain, Italy, and the U.K. But some of those places are now easing restrictions after these strict lockdowns. That's all beginning this week as cases decline. But the thing is, what public health researchers tell me when I ask, like, where are we at in this pandemic? They all stress that, like, we're in the beginning of this thing. Bill Hannage is an epidemiologist at Harvard.
I think that people are wishful. I really do think people are wishful. People want this all to be over. There is this wrong thought that people have, which is that you get through this period of whatever counts for lockdown, wherever you are, because there's a lot of different things that are calling themselves lockdown. You get through this, and then we'll just open the doors and everything will go back to normal.
So, Ilana, we shouldn't get overly optimistic for sure, but why is it that 2 months into this pandemic, we're still in what we call the beginning of it?
What Bill and others mean is that a lot of the world still hasn't been infected, and that makes them really susceptible and vulnerable to the virus. Basically, to be at a later stage in a pandemic, you need to have something like 60% of the population exposed or over it, or of course, have a vaccine. But we're just not there yet. And so even in places that have been hit the hardest, whether that's New York or elsewhere, and even with the highest projections, those percentages just still don't add up to having that level of people exposed. And that's why health leaders are also on this like high alert when you have the easing of lockdowns about whether there could be more cases and how to contain that. And then at the same time, they're still learning. They still don't quite know what it means to be exposed, whether you have like a long-term immunity. There's some diseases like dengue that if you get infected again, it's actually worse. So there's just a lot still to be understood about this virus and also how this might play out in waves in the future.
Yeah, it also occurs to me that the coronavirus seems to be playing out so differently in so many different places. Like, what is happening? What is the spectrum of the infection and how intense it is?
Yeah, I mean, the main thing is that even though this is one pandemic, it's many, many different outbreaks around the globe, depending on where you are. So you have places in Asia where they were hit first, where they had these peaks. Now they're on the alert for resurgences. And on the other hand, you have places like in Africa that appear to be just at the beginning of early reporting of cases.
And why is there this variation?
There's a lot of factors that can contribute to that, whether that's like how a government's control strategy is playing out in a community, like with the testing and the tracing and the containment. But some of it also has to do with the timing and the way it spreads. So I talked to Jess Metcalf. She's a demographer and evolutionary biologist at Princeton.
It also seems to be the fact that there's a lot of super spreading events associated with this virus.
So super spreading events, Marco, think about like small percentages of people that seem to be spreading it to lots of other people. Maybe they were at a gathering, like was reported on the show in Las Vegas, how people from all over the world came, and then that can kind of set forth something. On the other hand, there's these other details about a population, like aging populations like in Italy seem to be more susceptible. And then even with that, there are these outliers that still have researchers wondering about. So Jess gave me this example that's really close to her heart.
My parents live in Bangkok in Thailand. Thailand is a relatively aging population relative to much of the rest of Southeast Asia. And yet there just don't seem to be that many cases.
So she still has all these questions. But what is becoming clearer is that this virus will be with us for some time.
The World's Ilana Gordon, thanks very much for getting us started today.
You're welcome.
Among the countries hardest hit by the coronavirus is Ecuador. On a per capita basis, Ecuador's rate of infection is way higher than any other country in South America. Things have been especially bad in the crowded coastal city of Guayaquil. Public hospitals have been so overwhelmed, bodies have been left in bags on the street. As the world's Jorge Valencia reports, funeral homes are only now starting to catch up with the sudden demand for their services.
Over the last weekend or so, Edgar Herrera has just started to spend time with family.
Yeah. Karen, estoy teniendo llamada.
When I reach him, he asks his 3-year-old daughter to be quiet so he can speak. Herrera runs the Saexe Funeral Home in Ecuador's coastal city of Guayaquil. The city of about 3 million people has been reeling from COVID-19 for weeks.
Yo trabajaba de las 8 de la mañana que me despertaba a atender llamadas.
I would start taking phone calls at 8 in the morning and work until midnight, Herrera says. And while he and many others in Guayaquil are still in emergency response mode, they're beginning to catch their breath.
Es correcto. Nos estamos poniendo al día en toda esta situación que ocurrió.
Ecuador is reporting more than 27,000 coronavirus cases. But it's hard to say just how many people have died from COVID-19 because there's limited testing.
Se llegaron a sepultar más de 500 cuerpos en un solo día.
Herrera tells me his city was burying more than 500 people a day in mid-April. For comparison, he says a busy day last year would have seen something like 50.
Hubo un momento, un señor que...
There was one case that when Herrera's workers arrived at a dead man's home, they found his body had been decomposing for 5 days.
Incluso uno de nuestros empleados le dio la muerte blanca, que le llaman.
Herrera says one of his employees got what he calls the white death. In other words, he turned pale white and almost fainted. It's not so uncommon for people to die outside of hospitals in Guayaquil, says Jenny Garcia. She's with the National Institute of Demographic Studies in France and studies mortality patterns across Latin America.
This is not unusual in Ecuador. In Ecuador, around 40% of deaths occur outside the health system.
But what's not clear is why Ecuador, and Guayaquil in particular, has been hit so much harder than the rest of South America. Garcia says cities across the continent are similarly vulnerable, with dense populations and many people living in poverty.
It's not just the coronavirus that is happening in Latin America. We have the worst dengue crisis historically. In this moment, we have problems of all kinds. If the health system are collapsed, we are going to have an increase of death of other causes too.
Ecuador's public health ministry says more than 1,300 people have died from the coronavirus. That is probably a severe undercount if you ask any funeral home director in the country.
Mira, ¿sabes cuál es el problema?
Viviana Olivares runs another funeral home in Guayaquil.
¿Por qué? Porque mueren sin ni siquiera haberles hecho el examen.
Olivares says many people who are dying appear to have not been tested. She says death certificates will give causes that seem related, such as respiratory problems.
Respiratoria, pero no te ponen en el certificado de defunción COVID-19.
But she says the death certificates won't say anything directly about COVID-19. Edgar Herrera from Saexe Funeral Home says he's not all that interested in a precise figure. In fact, he says he stopped paying attention to the news altogether.
Bueno, realmente te cuento que yo dejé de ver noticias.
He says he's been doing whatever he can to take care of his mental as well as his physical health. Herrera says a client recently gave him thanks and offered to shake his hand. Herrera says he replied that when all this is over, they can give each other a hug instead. But for now, let's keep a safe distance. For The World, I'm Jorge Valencia.
Today, Belgium is gradually lifting some restrictions on its lockdown. Belgium has the world's highest mortality rate from the coronavirus. Not what you think. Belgium isn't necessarily doing a bad job in handling the pandemic. It's just counting things differently. Steven van Gucht is a virologist and government spokesman in Belgium. So recently, President Trump pointed to a graph showing that in terms of population size, the U.S. ranks number 7 in mortality rates, while Belgium ranks number 1.
Our mortality rate is far lower than other nations of Western Europe, with the lone exception of possibly Germany. This includes the U.K., Switzerland, Belgium, the Netherlands, Italy, France.
You say this is an inaccurate comparison. Why is that?
Yeah, it's highly inaccurate because the way Belgium is counting our deaths is different than the way other countries are doing this. Actually, we are not only counting the deaths in the hospital, which are confirmed with a laboratory test, whether or not they have been infected by the virus, but we also count probable cases which occur outside of the hospital. And a lot of these cases haven't necessarily been tested. So we suspect, based on the clinical symptoms and the possibility of exposure, that these are also COVID-related deaths. And actually, it's more than half of the death count in Belgium. So if you want to compare the Belgian figures with figures from other countries, you almost have to divide our number by 2. So it's difficult at this moment to just compare the figures. But that doesn't take away that Belgium indeed has been hit very hard by the virus. We saw our peak somewhere in the beginning of April, and now in the meantime, the numbers have gone down, and we believe that it is possible now to lift some of the measures, but very prudently, very cautiously.
I mean, it may be a transparent way of counting mortality, but there are some people who look at those numbers in Belgium and say, well, maybe the country isn't handling the pandemic so well, so this method is politically unpopular. What do you say to that?
Well, we don't do it for political reasons. It's to protect the health of Belgians. And for that purpose, this is the best way of counting and the best way of reporting. We saw there was a problem emerging in nursing homes that the strategies were adapted and we needed to do much more than we were doing at that time. It's also the epidemiologically the correct way of measuring the impact of an epidemic. If you would talk with people from WHO or CDC, they will say I'm 100% right. That you cannot only rely on laboratory confirmed cases, you also have to look at the probable cases, especially in a setting where you know test capacity is insufficient. And this is almost the case everywhere in the world. So it's really good practice.
So counting differently in Belgium, what does that mean in terms of ICUs and hospitals and getting the right PPE? Has the government been able to better prepare for that?
Already in peacetime, we are one of the countries with the highest number of ICU, of intensive care units in the world, or especially in Europe. And we increased the capacity drastically at the beginning of the epidemic. So even at the peak of the epidemic, which again was somewhere beginning of April, we only reached 58% of occupancy in the ICU units. So there was still a lot of buffer left. We still had space to accept new patients. On a nation scale, we never had a problem with ICU capacity or other beds in the hospital for this wave. Of course, in the future, if we might get hit a second time, and maybe if it's a bigger wave, it might become more difficult. But now we managed quite well.
Steven van Gucht is a virologist and government spokesman in Belgium. Thank you very much for being with us.
Okay, my pleasure. Have a good day.
If you've got questions about how to cope during these times, join us tomorrow at noon Eastern for a Facebook Live about mental health with Dr. Karistan Konen, psychiatric epidemiologist with Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health. Email your questions to myworld@theworld.org. And tomorrow, stream the discussion live at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. The Pentagon took a rare step recently. It acknowledged that an American airstrike killed two civilians in Somalia. It's worth noting that the strike took place more than a year ago, part of a 12-year-old campaign against al-Shabaab, the extremist group. It's also worth noting that airstrikes have risen in frequency under President Trump. But as the world's Halima Gikandi reports, this is only the second time the U.S. Africa Command, or AFRICOM, has acknowledged civilian deaths.
The last time Abdullahi Abdirahman Ali Wador spoke with his 70-year-old father was on March 6th. Wador lives in London now, but his father had never left his hometown of Mogadishu in Somalia. It was a regular Friday afternoon, and Wador's father had just finished praying at a local mosque when he called to check in.
Me and him, we just talk normal thing, the money that they need, and what is everything okay? He asks me about my family, my kids and stuff, and everything okay, and then about this coronavirus and stuff, you heard about the news.
Wador still remembers that day, because when he told his 5-year-old daughter he had spoken with Grandpa, she got really excited.
She told me, Dad, we're going to send a letter to him. I'm going to write a letter, and we're going to send to your daddy. And on Tuesday morning, she reminded me.
But that letter would never be sent. That same day, Wador got a different call, this time from his 19-year-old brother in Mogadishu.
And he goes, Dad was killed. And what happened? And he goes, he was killed by drones and stuff. And I didn't believe him. And I say, no, that's a mistake. You can't just kill him. So just find out more.
Wador learned that his father had traveled to settle some family business in the town of Jenale. It's a stronghold of the terrorist group al-Shabaab. According to Wador's relative, a U.S. drone strike hit the minibus he was in. Wador says he didn't believe it until he saw pictures sent by relatives and posted online.
How do they just sleep at night? Some guy with a drone like a PlayStation, the way we play PlayStation, he goes and flies and kills some people.
The U.S. military has been active in Somalia since 2007. It's working with the Somali government and African Union forces to fight al-Shabaab and ISIS, two terrorist groups seeking to control the country. For years, human rights organizations have been sounding the alarm about civilian deaths. Daphne Aviatar is with Amnesty International.
It's under the laws of war, the government is supposed to minimize civilian casualties and take all reasonable precautions to prevent civilian casualties, and then to provide accountability when civilians are killed.
Aviatar says Congress now requires that all claims of civilian casualties are investigated and those findings are made public. But there's still a lot of secrecy when it comes to how AFRICOM decides who is a civilian and who isn't.
So the government can just say whoever was killed, oh, they were members of this terrorist group and we're at war with that terrorist group, and therefore these killings were all fine. And they don't have to classify them as civilians.
The day Wador's father died, AFRICOM released a statement. It said the airstrike in Jenale on March 10th had killed 5 terrorists. Wador says his father was not a terrorist.
Innocent people, 70 years old, who is innocent and who is a disabled man who never did anything wrong all his life, and he has 6 kids.
This wouldn't be the first time AFRICOM got it wrong. Last week, it released the first ever quarterly report on civilian casualty allegations. The report acknowledged that 2 civilians were likely killed in a U.S. airstrike in February of last year, and 3 others were injured. Chris Woods is the director of Air Wars, a nonprofit organization that monitors civilian deaths and injuries in conflicts around the world, including Somalia. Woods says the new AFRICOM report represents a big step in transparency.
Certainly in the last year or so, we have seen significant strides forward by AFRICOM, bringing themselves up to the wider standards of other U.S. military commands.
But Woods says there are still a lot of unanswered questions about the civilian toll of U.S. operations in Somalia. He says suspected covert and special operations, for example, are not acknowledged by AFRICOM.
We now know far less about U.S. covert actions in places like Somalia and Yemen than we did a few years ago under President Obama.
Wood says there are big discrepancies between what the U.S. military is willing to acknowledge and what's being reported by local Somali communities. They've been documenting civilian casualties online and in local media outlets. The strike that Wador says killed his father was discussed on a local TV channel. Chris Wood says it's important for the U.S. military to pay attention to what's being reported by Somalis.
If they stay silent on civilian harm allegations, it does them no favors, because militant terrorist organizations will exploit that silence for propaganda purposes. And that's exactly what has been happening in Somalia.
AFRICOM is still reviewing the airstrike on March 10th. Wador tells me he feels angry and helpless about the death of his father. If the Americans are killing civilians, he says, they're doing exactly what Al-Shabaab is doing.
If you're killing civilians, then you're the same. Al-Shabaab, they kill civilians all the time. They kill kids. They kill mamas, women, all of that. And I thought, okay, the better people were United States.
AFRICOM says it's launching a website for people to report allegations of civilian deaths and injuries in local languages, and that it will be up and running by the end of the month. For the world, I'm Halima Gikandi.
Not to add to your anxiety, but there is a lot to worry about right now. Staying healthy, keeping your job, or finding a new source of income. Your mind is on family and friends, hoping they're doing okay. So here's the question for today's entry in the Corona Diaries. What's troubling you? Here's what we heard from one contributor in Lima, Peru.
Right before Corona hit, I was thinking a lot about how climate change and the uncertainty that that was causing was going to change how we understand the future and how we understand our plans and how we think and plan for our lives. I think that the last few decades in particularly, like the kind of like the consolidation of capitalism in the last few decades, has really required us to think that the future is a stable entity and to think that the future is going to always lead to more growth. And I was always thinking, you know, in the face of an environmental catastrophe, how does that change and what does it lead to, like politically, emotionally, for communities? But I thought that was going to be like a slow transition into realizing that. And now I think we've all been hit in the face by it. What's also troubling me is how sheltered we've all been, because through this crisis, I keep thinking this not being able to hug your family, not being able to go outside. So many people have only known this throughout their whole lives. But now it strikes us as tragedy.
A perspective from Lima, Peru for today's Corona Diaries. The Corona Diaries are supported by the Nieman Foundation for Journalism at Harvard and the MIT Center for Advanced Virtuality. You can listen to more diary entries and even upload your own at theworld.org. News headlines are coming right up. You're listening to The World. Stay positive for the future. That's what some Dutch artists were thinking when they designed a poster for a hospital. And then
thought, yeah, okay, but why only helping one friend or one hospital?
Enter crowdsourced art, where anyone can print for free and express their thoughts about the pandemic. That's still coming up here on The World. Remember the good old days, not that long ago, when we could shake hands, even hug our friends? We all need to be touched, and that is not a line in a love song. That is science. So what sort of effect could this side of social distancing have on us? From London, here's The World's Orla Barry.
Amanda Whitlock lives on her own in an apartment in Chicago. She's a photo editor and says she's usually perfectly happy in her own company, or at least that used to be the case. Since going into lockdown in early March, Whitlock says she's acutely aware of the fact that she's not had any physical contact with another human being.
I'm someone that has anxiety anyway. The last few days, I think it's really been pretty heavy on me. You know, it would be nice to be able to go out and hang out with someone and hold their hand, you know, something as simple as that.
Whitlock's anxiety is real. Scientific studies show physical contact with other people reduces our sense of stress. Evolutionary psychologist Robin Dunbar says it all goes back to our ancestry.
The way it works in monkeys and apes is through grooming of the fur that they do. And we don't have much fur left, only on the top of our heads. But what we've done is used stroking and patting and cuddling as a substitute, which still has the same effects. And not only does it build your friendships, but has a dramatic effect on your well-being, your general health.
Dunbar says we don't yet know what impact the absence of human touch is having on people right now. Playwright E. Wensler, who now goes by the name V, worries that fear of the virus is affecting the way we view our bodies.
I think there's something about going out and seeing people being afraid of each other and afraid of each other's bodies and afraid to touch and touch becoming something equated with sickness and death. It scares me deeply that we could begin to perceive each other's bodies as instruments of death.
V says the pandemic reminds her of the AIDS crisis in the 1980s and how that changed people's attitudes to sex.
It definitely changed our relationship to sex and to freedom drastically. And I so don't want COVID to do this to our relationship to touch. That would be a huge loss for human beings.
Sexual intimacy is out of the question for many people right now. But for some who work in the sex industry, it's business as usual. Charlotte Rose is an advocate for sex workers in Britain. She says many of them can't access emergency financial support from the government.
There is a large percentage that are still working because they can't claim. A lot of sex workers, especially migrant sex workers, aren't eligible either. So unfortunately, people are still offering skin-on-skin contact.
Rose says she used to work in the industry and that for many of her clients, it wasn't just about sex.
When I was working full time, probably about 90% of my clients wasn't even about the intercourse side of it. It was just skin on skin contact. I mean, I was predominantly seeing people with disabilities and, you know, they're already a very marginalised and vulnerable group. And they're the ones that are suffering incredibly at this particular time.
Physical contact is also central to Ruth McKinnon's work. She's a sports and remedial massage therapist from Canada, now working in London. McKinnon says people come to see her for a variety of reasons.
My clients range from a general, I've had this nagging pain, where you can link it to something that they did. And then a lot of it was stress levels. So people who are highly stressed generally are not sleeping very well. So getting massage regularly, they started to sleep better. Thus, their body was able to start, you know, making the right chemical processes for them to feel better.
But McKinnon says she hasn't been able to work since mid-March because the British government ordered therapy clinics to close and no one knows when they'll reopen. There is some good news, though. Psychologist Robin Dunbar says talking to someone on Skype or Zoom might not be the same as a real-life hug, but it still helps.
There's something about the feeling that you're in the room together. You stare into the eyeballs as well. You can see the smile breaking on their face before you've even finished the punchline of the joke you're telling them, which is probably why we have these enormous great white eyeballs so you can see exactly where somebody's looking.
Back in Chicago, Amanda Whitlock has been messaging a man she met through a mutual friend. For their next date, they plan to act out Shakespeare's The Tempest over FaceTime. Sounds fun, but I ask her what kind of date she'd really like to have.
Well, I don't think that's probably appropriate for the radio, but I would love to be able to text him and be like, hey, let's meet up. Or, you know, since we can't really go anywhere, find a safe way in one of our places to meet. That would be awesome. But I don't think it's going to happen.
For now, Whitlock is thankful for her two cats. She says they're really what's keeping her sane right now.
I think that if I didn't have my pets, they're my family. If I didn't have them, I would definitely be climbing the walls right now for some human contact.
For The World, I'm Orla Barry in London.
A business empire is defined as a large group of businesses controlled by a powerful person or company. To stand the test of time, it helps to be well diversified. Exhibit A, Richard Branson, the founder of Virgin.
From music records to airlines to finance to trains to publishing, the Virgin Empire...
Despite Virgin's diversity cracks are starting to show, Virgin Australia just filed for bankruptcy, and Branson is asking the British government for a tax bailout for Virgin Atlantic. Ken Button teaches at George Mason University, where he follows the airline industry. So Richard Branson and Virgin, I mean, even for people who don't follow business, probably they do know those two names. You can't almost say one without mentioning the other. Can Branson and Virgin exist without each other?
I think Branson can. Branson, as you said, is heavily diversified, and as a result of that, he can clearly survive for quite a while. He's got about £3 billion or so. I don't think he's going to go personally bankrupt. Virgin Atlantic, though, perhaps is a different kettle of fish. That was developed a long time ago as a sort of novel aviation. Branson's model is now somewhat dated and really needs a lot of refreshment to keep it going.
And then there are his promises for space travel with Virgin Galactic. I mean, that is a massive investment of capital. There seems to be a lot of ego involved with Branson's ventures. Is he humble enough to fail?
Well, he has failed. His railway interests in Britain are hardly a success. There's a lot of failures. He's quite robust in terms of being able to have water running off his back. But I also think you've got to remember he doesn't have huge amounts of money in many of the activities he's involved in. His Australian investments in Virgin Australia are 10%. I mean, he's got his money spread around. The butter's spread across a lot of slices of bread.
So what would failure look like for Richard Branson? Because he and his wife left the U.K., for the Virgin Islands as residents a few years back. He's no longer a taxpayer in the UK. Can he just let Virgin die if that happens and remain in the Caribbean in his hammock for the rest of his days?
I'm pretty sure he could if he wanted to. I do think you mentioned the word ego a little earlier, and that's important. Branson does have an ego, someone who's had his career coming from his origins and the way he's built up businesses. Very much personality. He wants himself to be up there up front. The problem is this is difficult. He's 69 now. He's not going to start jumping up into balloons and going around the world. He's got into Virgin activities, vacations in space and these sorts of things, which are very capital intensive. And the prospects of getting a return on those probably in his lifetime are pretty remote, really.
And did I read this correctly? He hasn't paid taxes in England in more than 10 years, but he now wants British taxpayers to help bail out Virgin Atlantic?
I don't know about his tax situation, to be honest with you. But the company itself is a registered British company. It's 51% owned by the Virgin Group in the British Virgin Islands and 49% owned by Delta Airways in America. So there's also a case of what Delta is going to do. They're pulling in their defenses and are putting most of the resources in the main Delta airline. So one can perhaps understand the British government being reticent to supporting Virgin Atlantic, not simply because of the Virgin Group's involvement in it, but also the other 49% of the shareholders.
I mean, Branson's always had this kind of narrative of the baby boomer bucking the traditional business norms. Maybe a 69-year-old man is not apt to change his ways, but do you think Branson will be able to adapt to a new way of doing business?
I think it's very difficult at 69. It's the image and things. You do have to adapt. He's always been up front. He's like people like Steve Jobs and that in the high-tech industry. But you also have a thing that aviation is now almost like a bus service. It's not the sort of sexy industry it was when he started out. The images now are more the people running Amazon, Bezos, Facebook, all those sorts of things. And that's not Branson's main area of activity. So I think the problem is perhaps the markets he's serving have changed and new markets have come along, which he's not really been heavily involved in. And changing in that is very, very difficult, I think.
Ken Button, professor at George Mason University, telling us about what next for Richard Branson. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Throughout history, quarantines have triggered artists to create. The bubonic plague inspired William Shakespeare. Norwegian painter Edvard Munch depicted the 1918 flu. Again today, artists are reflecting on our current pandemic. But this time, in cities across the globe, the crowdsourcing power of the internet is helping them bring COVID-19 art alive. Reporter Will Coley has our story.
This is a sound art project called Social Distance, Haiku, and You. Haikus are a Japanese form of poetry with 17 syllables within three lines.
Reeking of Clorox, I become unclean again. Return to the sink.
The artist Alan Nakagawa created the piece using poetry submitted by the public.
Haikus are fun because it's less about making a masterpiece poem and it's more about, yeah, I could do that, you know, three lines.
Alone, I live mute, unsure if my voice still works. Testing 1, 2, 3.
Alan collaborated with Cassandra Koblenz at the Orange County Museum of Art in California.
Cassandra, originally, did we think about how many we might possibly get?
Originally, we were worried we weren't going to get that many, actually. We had no idea we were going to get over 550 haikus.
From all over the world.
All over the world, people are experiencing life in lockdown, but they're figuring out creative ways to stay connected through the internet. They host virtual parties, cook meals together, and TikTok. And more, they share art. This is a virtual meeting of creatives from Barcelona, Spain. They recently founded the COVID Art Museum, which they host on Instagram. Every day they meet via WhatsApp to select images submitted by artists from around the world. The project is only a month old, but it has nearly 65,000 followers. Irene Yorka is one of the founders of the project. She's an art director at an ad agency.
It began the first days of quarantine in Spain. We realized that many of our friends were sharing art about the pandemic. That's when we decided to create a digital museum to collect all the amazing artworks that were being born.
To get out the word, Irene and her friends connected with Arte Informata, an international arts organization. So far, they've received nearly 5,000 submissions from 50 different countries. On a recent video call, Irene chose me one of her favorites. It's a painting of an American couple on vacation with funny tan lines on their faces.
They have the shape of the mask.
Oh, I see it. Yeah, yeah.
Things that we never thought of, but probably that is what is going to happen this summer, you know?
As a curator of the COVID Art Museum, Irene is able to spot worldwide trends in the art. There are toilet paper jokes before infection rates peak in a country. During the peak, the art is all about solidarity. Up in the Netherlands, another project aims to get art off the internet and onto people's walls.
My name is Menno de Bruin of Studio Lennart en de Bruin. We're a small creative graphic design agency.
Menno's project is called Stay Sane, Stay Safe. He and his business partner Max got the idea from a friend who works in a hospital.
He was asking if we had a nice poster, which we could send him with a nice uplifting message to help the people a bit. So then Max thought, yeah, okay, but why only helping one friend or one hospital?
Menno and Max quickly built a website and put out a worldwide call for poster designs. So far, more than 1,400 posters have been submitted by artists. One poster is an image of two hands wrapped in rubber gloves making a heart symbol. Another neon-colored poster reads in bold letters, "We will get through this together."
Well, it's quite a bright one. If you would skip the typography, it would still uplift your mood, I think.
Anyone can download and print out the posters for free. A printer in Utrecht made hundreds of the posters for Dutch hospitals. The medical staff love them.
The nice thing about the project that it's such a shared crisis that everybody understands the message we want to share.
The shared experience of quarantine is also what the Haiku project wants to capture. In fact, Alan Nakagawa connected all the submissions into a 90-minute time capsule on SoundCloud. Alan trained as a drummer and appreciates the pocket, the space between beats, which is why he loves haikus.
Haikus are amazing that way, in that it just invites your experiences to fill in the blanks and the empty space.
Sharing old stories, waiting to create new ones, locked down together.
People turn to art to document and make sense of hard times. Now in this digital age, it's no wonder that this art is being shared across the globe. For The World, I'm Will Coley.
The telephone rings. Put on my mask to answer. I'm losing my mind.
We've got a few of those artful messages of solidarity and hope at theworld.org. If the coronavirus isn't keeping you up at night, maybe this is. That's the sound of the giant Asian hornet. It's native to Southeast Asia and was recently spotted for the first time in the U.S. in Washington State.
The coolest part about the Vespa mandarinia, or Asian giant hornet, is that it's the largest hornet in the world, reaching sometimes slightly more than 2 inches for the largest queens.
That's Chris Looney, an entomologist with the Washington State Department of Agriculture. This giant insect is also known as simply the murder hornet. Their stings can cause anaphylactic shock. They've also been known to be super defensive, forming swarms to protect their nests.
They're rare, but when it does happen, they can cripple and occasionally even kill victims.
The hornets kill dozens of people each year in Japan. In 2013, in China's Shanxi province, swarms killed nearly 50 people and injured over 1,000. So far, only a handful of the hornets have been spotted in Washington State and British Columbia. If they multiply, people being stung is actually not the main concern.
The Asian giant hornet is certainly a big problem for beekeepers.
Far more at risk are North America's essential pollinators, honeybees. That was Kerry Clark, president of the British Columbia Honey Producers Association. He says the hornets are known to decapitate bees. In Asia, bees have adapted protective measures by swarming around the hornet. But North American bees are likely to be defenseless in their first clashes with the murder hornet. Clark says no one knows how the hornets made their way from East Asia to North America, but he hopes the few newcomers can be destroyed.
There's a short window of possibility of eradicating a species like that. Eradication is an optimistic goal anyway, because these things are not easily found.
Kerry Clark worries that by the time scientists figure out how they got to the U.S., it'll be too late to stop their spread. I hope you're all patient, people, because reopening economies, it is going to be a long, slow process. We'll have to continue for a while keeping a safe distance from one another in stores and restaurants. Going to the movies, that's going to be really tricky. In South Korea, it's interesting. Most multiplexes never closed during that country's outbreak, but many Korean movie lovers are not taking any chances. They and theaters are simply getting creative. Jason Strother has our story from Seoul.
It's date night for Kim Jong-hak and Lim Yuna, and they're gracious enough to let me tag along. The couple tells me the coronavirus has really disrupted their normal routine. Jong-hak is a 35-year-old web developer. Before the pandemic, they used to go to the movies up to 3 times a week. They've been a few times since, but only when the theater is mostly empty. Yuna, who's 28 and a baker, says she just doesn't feel comfortable inside a theater. Every time someone coughs, I put my mask back on or just move away from them. So tonight, we're going to Seoul's only drive-in. We find a parking spot a few rows back from the giant screen. An employee points out where the restrooms and concession stands are, and Jong-hak tunes in the radio to the channel playing the movie soundtrack. Tonight's film is La La Land, which we've all seen before. But re-releases are pretty much what every theater in South Korea is playing right now. And that concerns Park Jae-ho, whose family has run this drive-in for about 20 years. Sitting in the ticket office, Park says business is actually booming right now. Ticket sales are up 30%. It's mostly families who just feel safer watching movies through a windshield than in a multiplex. But he says he needs new films because that's what will keep customers coming. It might seem like a distant memory, but just a couple months ago, South Korean cinema was at the top of the world.
Parasite.
The dark comedy Parasite became the first non-English language film to take home the Oscar for Best Picture. It won acclaim from around the world. But COVID-19 has since brought the film industry here and elsewhere to a standstill. This is the biggest crisis the Korean film industry has ever seen, says Jason Bechaves. He writes and lectures on Korean cinema at Sungshil Cyber University in Seoul. But there's good news, he says, now that new coronavirus cases are dropping to the single digits daily.
We're seeing perhaps a sign that the industry is beginning to, I'm not sure returning to a sense of normality, but things certainly seem to be moving in the right direction in terms of getting the film industry up and running.
Some productions are still underway. New movies that were set to come out in March and April will come out this month. Bechevet says it's no surprise that the film industry here is bouncing back so fast.
It's reflected. I mean, it reflects where Korea is in terms of combating, you know, this virus. It's miles ahead of Europe and much of the West.
But for movie theaters, the question is, if they screen it, will they come? Some places are leaving rows of seats empty, making staff wear masks and checking temperatures. But one theater in Seoul is doing away with the interaction between guests and employees altogether. At this no-contact theater, the ticket takers are two roving robots. The snack bar is automated too. Cho Sung-jin is strategy director at CGV, one of Korea's largest theater chains. He says the company is thinking about making more theaters no contact if it helps ease people's concerns. Cho says there are delays with new Korean and Hollywood films. That means box office sales are likely to be slow for the rest of the year. But he says movies make people happy, so they'll stay open until life gets back to normal. Back at the drive-in, Kim Jong-hak and Lim Yoon-up can't agree on what's better, this or an indoor cinema. He says he's bored, but she says she likes the privacy and protection of being inside a car. But they do agree on one thing. The couple won't resume their weekly movie dates until the coronavirus pandemic is over and there are some new movies to go see. For The World, I'm Jason Strother in Seoul.
We hope you enjoyed today's feature. Please clean up around your seats or your car. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.